Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Anna Deavere Smith, who grew up in this town, is on her way back to Baltimore to take her work to center stage. The MacArthur Award-winning actor, playwright, educator, who has done incredible work over the years. Her latest piece is called Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, the Baltimore Chapter. And Anna, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
How are you?
Great. I'm good.
Y'all can join us here, 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Send us an email to talk@centershow.org, but do call 410-319-8888. So let me just step backwards for a moment, because many people know exactly a great deal about the work you've done over these many years. But
I'm just waiting for someone.
But
I'm sorry.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Other things go on behind us. But the work you've done over the years, building bridges, not walls, the voices of Bay Area women, Fires in the Mirror, especially Twilight, Los Angeles. Can you talk a bit? Let Me Down Easy. Can you talk just a bit for a second about your approach to this work and what this? Just describe the work to people who may not have heard your work before.
Well, it's basically based on interviews, and then I learned the interviews and performed the people. So in the case of Baltimore, I came after the riot, and I interviewed a bunch of people. I also did a lot of interviews in Northern California and Philadelphia, all on the subject of how come, you know, our kids, mostly African American, Native American, and Latino, can't make it through school. And the bad news is that some of them end up in a criminal justice program. So what your audience will see at Center Stage is some portrayals that I have created based on those interviews.
And the interviews you've been doing, I mean, I think that when you do these, what you're doing on stage is you take on the embodiment of the people you've interviewed. They become your characters on stage.
That's right.
And the way you do it with your craft is to make simple changes, right? Sweatshirts, canes, sitting down, standing up.
Yeah, or the case of Baltimore, nothing. For the most part.
Really?
No props, yeah. I'm doing something special for you guys.
That's good. So can you talk a bit about the kinds of people you interviewed for this process, what you were going after?
Well, everything from, I would say, you know, cops to people who run prisons to neuroendocrinologists and the kids themselves. I went into a facility in Maryland, and that used to be called Oak Hill,
yes.
You know, for boys, right? And it's been redone as New Directions Academy, the Maya Angelou Academy. I went in there and talked to some young people, so judges, lawyers, a wide variety of people. In Baltimore, I talked to Kevin Moore, who is known for taking the video of Freddie Gray,
the arrest video, right?
Yeah, the mayor. All kinds of folks. Alan Bullock, who folks will remember, has been accused of tearing up a police car.
Right.
During, I don't know whether you call it a riot or an unrest. So lots of folks, some members of your clergy, Jamal Bryant, your leaders, and then across the country, parents, all kinds of folks trying to really, psychiatrists, trying to get at, you know, what happened. And for me, it's important to come back to Baltimore because I was raised by teachers. You know, my mother was a teacher, all her friends were teachers, and there was a lot of promise, even though we had a still form of segregation. Many people would say things are much worse off now. So my point is to ask this community what they can do. I'm coming back home to do something about it. I'm going to stop the show in the middle and send the audience off into small groups to come up with ideas. We all have to come forward. We all have to do something. We can't continue down this road. I mean, it is a security problem for the nation. It's an economic problem, and it's a moral problem. We're just throwing folks away, and we got to turn it around.
So I'm curious. A couple things. One thing you just said, I'm curious about what's happened to you in this process. When you, I know you grew up in Baltimore. You went to Western,
I went to Morgan. I went to Morgan one summer.
You went to Morgan as well.
Yeah, I had a great summer at Morgan. Really great summer.
So you grew up though, as you mentioned, in the world of Baltimore that was legally segregated at the time.
No, de facto, not legally.
Well, no, you couldn't eat in certain restaurants. Couldn't go to movie,
well,
certain
no,
movie
I
theaters?
Mean, it wasn't legal segregation. It was just the fact, you know, for example, my school, my elementary school, James Mosher Elementary, was all kids, black kids. And then there were two Japanese girls, but, you know, when you have a black and white situation, you don't know how to categorize
right,
it.
Right.
And then when I went to high school, I went to Garrison, which was predominantly white, and it was pretty much a nightmare to be there. By the time I got to Western, things were better. The girls were better. The Garrison was just a horrible, horrible place, I think, for a young...
I went there, too, I know.
Time, a colored girl, you know, a young Negro girl.
Right.
Awful, awful. So nobody was spitting at me or beating me up, but the fact was there were still a lot of rough edges in terms of, you know, did anybody care about me? And my sense is that now that's what a lot of kids face. And I'm careful not to blame teachers for this. You know, this. I started the project under the title of the School-to-Prison Pipeline, and I'm going to change that because I think it sounds like we're blaming schools and blaming teachers for something that's a much bigger problem. It is a problem of poverty. You know, I don't need to tell you. I left Baltimore when I was 16, but, you know, I don't need to tell you what happened when Jobs left Baltimore, you know, when, you know, people could have a nice middle-class existence working at Bethlehem Steel. And now when I go home, I see it's your city, your city. I come from there, but it's almost like a foreign country to me with all the boarded up buildings. So when we think of our young people, it's not fair to blame schools for something that is a much bigger problem.
No, I think that's a very important point. What I was saying earlier was the city was, the restaurants and other places were legally segregated in Baltimore when we were kids.
The restaurants weren't actually legally segregated, but the fact was that people behaved as though we were still in segregation. I mean, I think, you know, when I was really little, my mother told the story of taking me into a department store where she could get in the department store, but they wouldn't let black people, Negro people, try on clothes.
Right.
And the lady famously, at least in my life, said to my mother, well, she looks clean, let me slip her in. So that's what it was like. And then, of course, there were amusement parks and stuff like that that legally we could not go to in other parts of Maryland.
Right, right. I mean, there was a whole civil rights movement. Many of us, I got arrested, the White Coffee Pot, places like that. But going back to the work you've done, so I'm curious what you've learned in this process. You said that one of the things you said a moment ago was that what you're discovering in all these interviews, whether they're in California or here, that things may be worse than they were.
Yeah, they are. I think, you know,
what are you discovering?
Well, first of all, you know, 2 years ago, I think it's 2 years ago, 1 year ago, was the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Ed. And most people felt that we are worse off now than we were then. I'm finding out, you know, one of your Baltimore heroes, Freeman Hrabowski, pointed out to me in his interview that the overwhelming majority of kids who start college, who are like the first of their family to go to college or, you know, from lower incomes, don't finish college. And some of these colleges, particularly the for-profit ones, take advantage of that. I'm finding that stress has a huge effect on whether kids can go to school ready to work. You know, this expression of do they have the self-regulation to sit through school? And, of course, that starts at 2 years old. I mean, you know, how do you deal with your kid in the so-called terrible twos? I don't know. But... You know, do they escape the terrible twos, and are they ready to sit down and listen to a teacher as 4 years old or 5 years old? And then we have these horrific images that we come across of 5 year olds being handcuffed for being, you know, having a tantrum. So we know that also since the 80s, there's been a climb in, zero tolerance, which is, of course, accompanied by three strikes and all of those things. And all of this stuff crept its way into our schools, as one of the people, brilliant educator, says, you know, in the show, he says that there's a kind of dehumanization that has occurred in America that is epitomized by the prison experience, But it's not limited to that.
Mm.
You know, this coarseness that many of us have and just to get through life. And so we find that coarseness inside of our schools, affecting our children. And when I grew up, the Baltimore I grew up in, I would say there was a great generosity and there was a great kindness within the black community. You know, some folks say that the downside of ending segregation is, you know, that we lost that kind of exemplary way that we had of caring for one another. You know, my mother had these boys. She taught sixth grade. It was committed. Nobody would get out of her class without reading. And, you know, she'd bring them home. They were 13 years old. She'd sit them down at the dining room table. Now kids are 19 years old with a 1.7 reading level. I mean, what has happened?
And what do you think has happened? What do you think has happened from the work you've been doing?
I think that lots of things. I think that we are in a different kind of modern world than then. The world is bigger. There are stresses on people. I would tell you that I know that there's an epidemic, a worldwide epidemic of depression. I think our children have not escaped that. So I think that as humans now, we are in a much more complicated, stressful world, and that is having an impact on us psychologically and on our general spirit. I think that values have dropped out of communities. I certainly believe, and I almost didn't say it because it's such a cliche, that the presence of drugs in our community steals kids as early as 13, 14 years old, they're dealing. And that has as much to do with why they're dropping out of school. You know, parents don't have money, as one of the judges in Philly told me, and that's where they end up. You know, we all talk about how the government knows everything about us. They know everything about us. They can read our emails. They can look in our windows. They can know what we're doing at home by the electronics on our stove. Well, if that's the case, why can't they get the drugs and the guns out of these neighborhoods?
And so have you come up with, I know you, it's not fair to maybe ask this, but have you come up with like what you think are potential answers for this from the people you've interviewed?
Well, you know, that's why I stopped the show in the middle.
Uh-huh.
That's why, Mark, I stopped it in the middle. I know the limitations of what I can do. I can talk to people. I can listen. I can act like people. I was a mimic when I was a little girl. And me and Marcus Shelby, the fantastic bass players with me, you know, we come out of the black tradition of call and response, right? Field hollers. So I see that what we're doing is hollering. We're going to stop the show. I know that there's somebody in that audience who can write a bigger check than me. There's somebody who knows more about incarceration than that audience because they've got somebody in their family incarcerated, somebody who knows a whole lot more about child development than me. And I'm just, what I'm trying to do is to make the invitation for action. And the good news is I am meeting all kinds of people, from judges to a famous neuroendocrinologist, to politicians, to the kids and parents themselves, parent activists I met in Philly who are doing stuff, and we just need to coordinate that. I would like to see schools be reinvented. Mm. If we expect schools to deal with kids who are hungry and traumatized and all of these things who can't possibly compete with the kids I teach at NYU, you know, somebody was reading to them in the womb, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can't possibly compete, right? So if we expect schools to do this, then we have to reinvent what they are. They have to be more like community centers, you know, where there's all kinds of stuff. Bring gym back, right? Increase the number of therapists to help these kids get through. And last thing I'll say, I'm certainly talking an awful lot right here.
That's fine.
Professor Amy Roser at Goucher, who has a program, bringing Goucher College into the institutions, into our facilities, into prisons, says to me, she says it best. She says, we put all this money on the back end. Imagine what it costs, not just to build a prison, but to feed a prisoner, to give therapy to a prisoner, right? To tutor a prisoner, to make a college education for a prisoner. We put all the money on the back end. So what happens if we shift it to the front end and try to catch this while kids are still young and impressionable? And it's the one place that Democrats and Republicans agree. We've got to shut down the prisons. We're incarcerating more people than any country in the world. So, you know what? I bring bad news, but I bring bad news to suggest good news. I really think that an exciting time is in front of us.
No, and I think that that's the part of the power here that you have as an artist, as an actor, as a writer, to bring that, when you bring that to life, it makes people kind of feel things they wouldn't feel, especially if it's a middle, upper middle class audiences whose world is not directly affected, though it is affected, and don't feel what's going on that way because they're not in it. If you bring that into their minds and hearts, that's how the change begins, or part of it anyway.
I hope you're right. Well, we live in such a separated society.
Yes, right.
You know, I mean, you and I probably go to cities where we don't even see the black people, right? They're off, you know, they're hidden away, right? We've gone backwards, right? So if we don't even see each other, how can people who have advantages even feel any compassion,
right,
if they don't see that struggle because they're too involved in their own lives? So I think that it is, this sounds like soft language, but as much as it's a political problem and a policy problem, I think it's a spiritual problem. And it's a big moral crisis that we have in our country.
And I think that's correct. I mean, I think that what you're laying out here is important. I'm glad you're bringing it here. I mean, we said in the last hour here, another conversation we had, I'm hard put within the city limits itself. I can name some neighborhoods outside of Northeast Baltimore County, but in the city itself, I can't think of a neighborhood, poor, middle class, upper class, or wealthy, that's really racially mixed.
Isn't that awful? That is just awful. Awful. Well, Baltimore is my inspiration to even do this project because I heard a story about a principal, about a school in Baltimore where a kid urinated in a water cooler and they were going to arrest the kid. And I just couldn't get it out of my mind. And the next day, some of your listeners will know that I played Mrs. Acolytis on a show that ran for 7 years called Nurse Jackie.
Right, I remember.
Edie Falco, yeah. And there was this terrific British actress on the show called Eve Best. And so the next morning after I heard that story, we were having hair and makeup done together. And I said, you know, I can't get this out of my mind about this kid who was going to be arrested for urinating in a water cooler. And she said, in that fabulous British accent, oh, well, whatever happened to mischief? And then it clicked.
Exactly.
Then it clicked that rich kids get mischief and poor kids get pathologized. And that was happening right in my city. And I said, you know what? It's time for me to go home.
Well, I'm glad you are coming home for a bit, and I look forward to seeing it this coming weekend, see what we're going to be doing, and I'm so happy you're bringing it home. Anna Deavere Smith will present a reading of her work, followed by small group discussions about how to affect change. It'll be at Center Stage this Saturday and Sunday. You can get more information at centerstage.org, and it's Notes from the Field, Doing Time in Education, the Baltimore chapter. And I'm really happy to hear that after all this work she's been done here, that she's bringing it to the stage here. Anna Deavere Smith, I really look forward to it, and I thank you so much for taking your time today.
Oh, my goodness. I thank you for this time. I really do. I mean, you're doing something right now just by airing these things, and I'm proud to be talking to you.
Thank you so much. See you this weekend.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. When we do come back, it's Baltimore City Paper Time.